Defectors who return to their former positions inside opposition military or political organizations are provided with a secure means of contacting their CIA case officer's principal agent, to whom they feed information leading to the arrest or ambush of enemy cadres and secret agents. Some function for years as penetration agents and provide the greatest prize of all, strategic information on the enemy's plans. Defector programs also provide CIA talent scouts with cover for recruiting criminals into CT and RD political action teams. Burglars, arsonists, forgers, and smugglers have unique skills and no compunctions about committing havoc. In Vietnam, the entire 52nd Ranger Battalion of the South Vietnamese Army was recruited from Saigon prisons. Military operations like President Obama's surge in 2010 provide security for CIA officers to conduct covert operations through instruments like the PRTs, which is the real reason the Taliban defector buyout program was launched concurrently with the surge. As I predicted in my 2010 article for Consortium News, the multi-million-dollar defector program was doomed from the start. Indeed, after all the hoopla associated with its debut, it fizzled out after 6 months. The Times attributed the failure to the fact that the Pashtuns realized it was a trick, while their ethnic rivals within the CIA's parallel government feared losing whatever gains they'd made if the Taliban were incorporated. The program was revived in 2014 by President Ashraf Ghani and aimed at high-level reconciliation through a High Peace Council, a moniker only Madison Avenue ad men could devise. Provincial peace councils were installed in 33 provinces. However, disarmament was a precondition, and disarmament meant surrender. Statistics supplied by the United Nations Development Program showed stunning success. 10,404 former combatants have so far renounced violence and joined the Peace and Reintegration Program. Of these, 10,286 received financial assistance to reintegrate into their communities. Other statistics are less encouraging. There were over 11,000 civilian casualties in Afghanistan in 2015, marking a steady increase since Obama's surge in 2010. As a stranger could see at a glance, mounting civilian deaths indicate anything but a desire on America's part for reconciliation in Afghanistan. Frank Scotton, a case studied in PSYOPs. In Vietnam, officers within the Political and Psychological Warfare branch of the CIA's Special Operations Division manage low-level defector programs. In doing so, they worked with U.S. Information Service, USIS, officers like Frank Scotton. The USIS was the overseas branch of the erstwhile U.S. Information Agency and specialized in the symbolic transformation of grim realities, like CIA-sanctioned drug trafficking, into happy myths that promoted the mythological American way. In their effort to convert the world into one big chamber of commerce, the CIA and USIS employed all manner of media from TV, radio, and satellites to armed propaganda teams, wanted posters, and selective terror. As noted in the previous chapter, Scotton played a pioneering role in U.S. political and psychological operations in Vietnam. After graduating from American University's College of International Relations in 1961, he received a graduate assistantship to the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii. CIA officer Lucian Conine told me that Scotton was recruited into the CIA while there, though Scotton insisted that he wasn't. Scotton did, however, acknowledge the CIA-sponsored East-West Center's espionage function. It was a cover for a training program in which Southeast Asians were brought to Hawaii and trained to go back to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos to create agent nets, he said. Scotton told Associate Professor of History Jeff Woods about his early days in Vietnam. Here's how Woods described what Psy War expert Scotton did. He went into the countryside alone, with a .45, a grease gun, and a bag of money. Scotton started in the Central Highlands, arranging meetings with local officials and learning what he could about the Viet Cong's People's War. He also met the wild group of multinational other warriors trying to pacify the Highlands. In an abandoned shack near Ankei, he found Englishmen Dick Noon, Norman Herbold, and a group of Malayans. Noon was especially interesting. His brother Pat had been an anthropologist in Malaya and the originator of Senoi dream theory, which held that the tribesmen's collective dream world could be shaped to influence group solidarity. Dick Noon had worked in Malaya shaping the dreams of the once peaceful Orang Asli Aborigines, organizing them into the Senoi Prak, a police unit noted for its ruthless slaughter of captured communist guerrillas. Noon convinced Scotton that his biggest problem in persuading the rural Vietnamese and Montagnards to brave the jungle and kill the VC was that he had not done it himself. The American immediately took the advice to heart. Whoever dared the vacuum could control the vacuum. Determined to earn the respect of the people he intended to recruit, the novice disappeared into the jungle, alone. He slept by day and laid ambush by night. Unsure who was VC and who was not, he let several armed black pajama-clad Vietnamese pass by without confrontation. After a few days of this, he encountered Nai Luet, a CIA-trained special forces operative who was hunting VC in the area. Luet told Scotton, in no uncertain terms, that any ethnic Vietnamese he encountered on the trails in the highlands at night were VC. He then handed Scotton a World War I bayonet and told him that if he carried it, the local Montagnards would recognize it as the sign of a VC killer and an ally. Luet then disappeared back into the jungle. By the end of his first week in the vacuum, Scotton had killed more than a half dozen VC guerrillas. Woods is describing Jason, the grotesque character wearing a goalie's mask in the popular slasher movies. When I speak of psycho CIA officers, think of Scotton. Who gave him the legal authority to go off on his own and kill all these people? Can CIA, USIS officers do anything they want, from drug dealing to mass murder? In any event, after proving his manhood the militant American way, Scotton turned his attention to energizing the Vietnamese through the carefully scripted political action that advanced American policies at the expense of the aspirations of average Vietnamese. In looking for people to mold into political cadres preaching the American line, Scotton turned to the CIA's defector program, which resided under cover of the State Department's Agency for International Development, and was named the Chu Hoi Open Arms Program. There, Scotton found the raw material needed to prove the viability of his experimental political action program. In Pleiku province, he worked with Captain Nguyen Thuy, a graduate of Fort Bragg's Special Warfare Center, who commanded the 4th Special Operations Detachment, and Thuy's case officer, U.S. Special Forces Captain Howard Walters. As part of their pilot program designed to induce defectors, Scotton, Walters, and Thuy set up an ambush in VC territory and waited until dark. When they spotted a VC unit, Scotton yelled in Vietnamese through a bullhorn, "You are being misled! You are being lied to! We promise you an education!" Full of purpose and allegory, he shot a flare into the night sky and hollered, "Walk toward the light!" To his surprise, two men defected, convincing him and his CIA bosses that a determined GVN unit could contest the VC in terms of combat and propaganda. Back in camp, Scotton told the defectors to divest themselves of untruths. Now, he said that certainly the U.S. perpetrated war crimes, but so did the VC. We acknowledged that theirs was the stronger force, but that didn't mean that everything they did was honorable and good and just, Scotton said. Scotton called his method the Motivational Indoctrination Program. Going National. In 1965, Tom Donahue, the chief of the CIA's covert action branch in Saigon, recognized the value of intelligence obtained through defectors. And in 1965, he authorized the establishment of Chu Hoi programs based on Scotton's motivational indoctrination method in each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces. In typical CIA style, there was nothing in writing, and nothing went through the central government. CIA officers managed the Chu Hoi program in the provinces, where the process worked as follows. Upon arriving at the Chuhoy Center, the defector was interviewed, and if he had information on the VCI, sent to the local province interrogation center. If he had tactical military information, he was sent to military interrogators. If a defector had the potential to serve in one of the RD cadre programs, the CIA put him on a plane and sent him to its indoctrination center in Vung Tau, where he was plied with special attention and wowed with eye-popping gadgets. The training was rigorous, but the defectors were treated well. They received medical care for infections, and the food was full of protein. Next came political indoctrination, lasting from 40 to 60 days depending on the individual, in which previously conscripted defectors preached the beauty of the American way. They had a formal course, said Jim Ward, the CIA officer in charge of Phoenix and the Delta, 1967 to 1969. They were shown movies and given lectures on democracy. Upon graduation, each defector was given an ID card, a meal, money, and a chance to gain redemption by killing former comrades. The Chuhoy program was thought to be so promising that in June 1967, Nelson Brigham incorporated it within the Phoenix program. Brigham appreciated Chuhoy as one of the few areas where police and paramilitary advisors cooperated. He also viewed the defector program as a means for the CIA to develop unilateral penetrations unknown to the South Vietnamese police. By 1969, the defector program was a centerpiece of pacification and was managed by military psyops teams like the one that penetrated NPR, replete with posters, banners, loudspeakers mounted on trucks, and leaflets falling from the skies. For example, on 22nd January 1970, 38,000 leaflets were dropped over three villages in Go Vap District. Addressed to specific VCI cadres identified by RD teams, they read, "Since you have joined the NLF, what have you done for your family or your village and hamlet? Or have you just broken up the happiness of many families and destroyed houses and land? Some people among you have been awakened. They have deserted the communist ranks and were received by the GVN and the people with open arms and family affection. You should be ready for the end if you remain in the communist ranks. You will be dealing with difficulties bigger from day to day and will suffer serious failure when the ARVN expand strongly. You had better return to your family, where you will be guaranteed safety and helped to establish a new life." Defects in the program. The military, CIA, and USIS were so convinced by their own propaganda that they funded TV and radio shows and produced movies with real actors to spread the word. And from the language of scripted Phoenix reports, one would think that the Chuhoy program was a rollicking success. All rallied VC, real and imagined, were included in Phoenix neutralization statistics, and by 1970, more than 100,000 were said to have been processed through 51 Chuhoy centers. Many so-called defectors, however, simply regurgitated the American line in order to win amnesty. They considered defector programs as a chance for R&R. They made a quick visit to their families, enjoyed a home-cooked meal, and then returned to the war for independence. According to AID Public Safety Advisor Douglas McCollum, who monitored the Chuhoy program in three provinces in Vietnam, it was the biggest hole in the net. They'd come in, we'd hold them, feed them, clothe them, get them a mat. Then we'd release them, and they'd wander around the city for a while, and then disappear. As American war managers knew full well, genuine defectors were pariahs in Vietnam's village-based culture. They could never go home. The same lesson applies in Afghanistan's tribal culture. In the 15 years of occupation, American and NATO forces are solely responsible for the deaths of thousands of innocent civilians. As a result, they have no popular support or connection to the people they wish to dominate. They can only reach the people through media like translated leaflets and bounty programs that offer rewards to traitors. Nothing could be a clearer indication of just how detached America's war managers are from the reality of life in Afghanistan's villages. And while the CIA relies on leaflets and motivational indoctrination programs to sell itself, The Taliban go from person to person, speaking a common tongue, proving that technology is no substitute for human contact. The tragedy is that America has no alternative to systematic brainwashing. And while brimming with the comic enthusiasm of an Amway convention or a Bible Belt religious revival, defector programs remain a serious business. Today, they are conducted secretly at high-security CIA bases in Afghanistan and Iraq, and occasionally produce spectacular results. For example, when the Bush regime was preparing the American public for the invasion of Iraq, the CIA recruited high-level defectors from the Iraqi army. Offers of Swiss bank accounts and positions of power in the liberated Iraq of the future were balanced with CIA-prepared scripts the defectors read to the U.S. media. Two such defectors were channeled to New York Times reporter Chris Hedges, who dutifully wrote an article titled, "Defectors Cite Iraqi Training for Terrorism" on 8 November 2001. The horrifying though patently untrue idea that Iraq was training terrorists to attack America had the intended effect, and public support for the pending war grew. In hopes of acquiring similar sources for domestic propaganda coups, all defector debriefing reports are sent to CIA stations for analysis and possible use against the American public, which alone can be fooled. It's a risky business, as evidenced by the Jordanian defector who turned out to be a triple agent and blew up a handful of CIA officers at FOB Chapman. But it's the only game in town. The United States was defeated in Vietnam for just this reason. And though packaged as a new initiative, the latest Taliban defector buyout program simply heralds a replay of the Vietnam experience in Afghanistan. Nothing new in the grim world of counterinsurgency. Chapter 8. Disrupting the Accommodation. CIA killings spell victory in Afghanistan and defeat in America. Why, everyone wondered, did a suicide bomber target the CIA, knowing that the most violent gang on Earth was going to start dropping bombs and slitting throats until its lust for revenge was satisfied? Over the course of its 70-year reign of terror, the CIA has overthrown countless governments, started innumerable wars, costing millions of innocent lives, and otherwise subverted and sabotaged friends and foes alike. Despite all this murder and mayhem, it has only lost around 100 officers. No one is supposed to kill CIA officers. No matter how many innocent women and children they destroy, CIA officers are the protected few. Why would the terrorists in Afghanistan suddenly deviate from the norm and throw the whole game into chaos? Consider the Afghan war veteran Micah Johnson, the black American who killed 5 Dallas cops in July 2016. Johnson was enraged because it doesn't matter how many black men cops kill, they are never punished. It doesn't matter that the cops have an accommodation with the criminal underworld or that their bosses allow their gangster informants to move drugs into black communities. Cops are members of the Universal Brotherhood of Officers. They exist above the law. The end. Granted, the Universal Brotherhood of Officers is hard for civilians to find, let alone comprehend. It exists in the twilight zone between imagination and reality, in Bob Kerry's Fog of War, in the realm of the insulated ruling class. It is why officers of opposing formal armies have more in common with one another than they have with their own enlisted men. Officers are trained to think of enlisted men as cannon fodder. They know when they send a bunch of foot soldiers up a hill, some of them will die. That's why they do not fraternize. That's why it's illegal for a working-class individual like me to speak the name of an active-duty CIA officer. It's also why civilians can't know the names of CIA commandos who shoot pregnant women and dig the bullets out of their corpses. The laws only apply to the little people and the defenseless. Only grand poobahs like Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, who leaked the name of CIA officer Valerie Plame to syndicated columnist Robert Novak back in 2003, can get away with it. Not only was it a felony, it was a political crime of the highest order, given that Armitage leaked Plame's name in retaliation for her husband, Joe Wilson, a career diplomat, having disproved the Bush's regime's big lie that Saddam Hussein had obtained enough yellow cake to build a nuclear bomb. This class distinction is the basis of the sacred accommodation. It's why the Bush family, despite its repeated denials, had the FBI round up the Saudi royals and fly them out of the U.S. the day after 9/11. If anyone was a case officer to the bombers, or knew about their plans, he was among those protected few. CIA officers are at the pinnacle of the Brotherhood. Blessed with fake identities and bodyguards, they fly around in private planes, live in villas, and kill with state-of-the-art technology. They tell Army generals what to do. They direct congressional committees. They assassinate heads of state and innocent children equally, with impunity, with indifference. In Afghanistan, CIA officers managed the drug trade from their hammocks in the shade. Opium production has soared since they purchased the government in 2001. They watch in amusement as addiction rates soar among young people whose parents have been killed and whose minds have been damaged by 15 years of U.S. aggression. They don't care that the drugs reach America's inner cities. CIA officers have an accommodation with the protected Afghan warlords who convert opium into heroin and sell it to the Russian mob. It's no different than cops working with the mafia in America. It's an accommodation with an enemy that ensures the political security of the ruling class. The CIA is authorized to negotiate with the enemy, but only if the channels are secure and deniable. It happened during the Iran-Contra scandal, when President Reagan won the love of the American people by promising never to negotiate with terrorists, while his two-faced administration sent CIA officers to Tehran to sell missiles to the Iranians and use the money to buy guns for the drug-dealing Contras. In Afghanistan, the accommodation within the drug underworld provides the CIA with a secure channel to the Taliban leadership to negotiate on simple matters like prisoner exchanges. The exchange of British journalist Peter Moore for an Iraqi insurgent in CIA custody was an example of how the accommodation worked in Iraq. Moore was held by a Shia group allegedly allied to Iran, and his freedom depended entirely on the CIA reaching an accommodation with leaders of the Iraqi resistance. The details of such prisoner exchanges are never revealed, but always lead to secret negotiations over larger issues of strategic importance to both sides. The criminal espionage underworld in Afghanistan provides the intellectual space for any eventual reconciliation. There are always preliminary negotiations for a ceasefire, and in every modern American conflict, that's the CIA's job. For the CIA has the best intelligence on family relationships in any nation where the U.S. is operating. CIA officer John Mason directed the Phoenix program from 1969 to 1971. In a 19 August 1969 New York Times article, Terrence Smith quoted Mason as saying, "Sometimes family relationships are involved. We know very well that if one of our units picks up the district chief's brother-in-law, he's going to be released." Ed Brady, an Army officer detailed to the CIA and assigned to the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon, explained how the accommodation worked in Vietnam. Brady told me how he and his Vietnamese counterpart, Colonel Tan, were lunching at a restaurant in Dalat. Casually, Tan nodded at a woman eating noodle soup and drinking coffee at the table near theirs. Colonel Tan whispered that the woman was the Viet Cong province chief's wife. Brady, of course, wanted to grab her and use her for bait. Colonel Tan said to Brady, "You don't understand. You don't live the way we live. You don't have any family here. You're going to go home when this operation is over. You don't think like you're going to live here forever. But I have a home and a family and kids that go to school. I have a wife that has to go to market, and you want me to kidnap his wife? You want me to set a trap for him and kill him when he comes in to see his wife? If we do that, what are they going to do to our wives?" The VC didn't run targeted operations against top GVN officials either, Brady explained. There were set rules that you played by. If you conducted a military operation and chased them down fair and square in the jungle, that was okay. If they ambushed you on the way back from a military operation, that was fair. But to conduct these clandestine police operations and really get at the heart of things, that was kind of immoral to them. That was not cricket. And the Vietnamese were very, very leery of upsetting that. Obama's dirty war in Afghanistan relies largely on immoral operations in which wives and children are used as bait to trap husbands, or are killed as a way of punishing men in the resistance. That is why CIA officers reign supreme. Like Brady in Vietnam, they have no personal, religious, or social connection with the indigenous population. They are not bound by moral rules and are free to slaughter with impunity. The CIA plays the same role in Afghanistan that the Gestapo and SS Einsatzgruppen performed in France in World War II, terrorizing the urban resistance and partisan bands in the countryside by targeting their friends and families. The CIA's objective is to rip apart poor and working-class families, and in the process, unravel the fabric of Afghan society until the Afghan people accept American domination. They don't care how long it takes either. Afghanistan is a means to get at Russia, similar to how Nixon played the China card in Vietnam. And that is why CIA officers were killed in Afghanistan. The Taliban have no reason to negotiate a settlement. They know history and that the racist elites in America will never accommodate them. As I said in 2010, the CIA is utterly predictable. I said it would invoke the symbolic 100-to-1 rule made famous by the Gestapo, and go on a killing spree, killing 100 Afghanis for every CIA officer killed until its lust for vengeance was satisfied. 2010 was indeed the deadliest year for civilians in Afghanistan since 2001. In 2013, the rate was still rising and included an alarming increase in women and children casualties, which reflected the changing dynamics of the conflict over the year, which was increasingly being waged in civilian communities and populated areas, the United Nations said. The statistics are skewed to blame civilian deaths on the Taliban, but even the U.S. military acknowledges the steady increase. As of June 2016, Afghans feel less secure than at any recent time, a new Pentagon report says, as Afghan battlefield deaths continue to escalate and civilian casualties hit a record high. Perceptions of security remain near all-time lows, the report said, adding that only 20% of Afghans surveyed in March called security good. That is a drop from 39% a year earlier. In the latest polling, 42% of Afghans said security is worse now than during the time of the Taliban, which ruled the country from 1996 to late 2001, when U.S. troops invaded to eliminate an al-Qaeda sanctuary. The report called the 42% figure a historic high. The Afghan people hate the Americans more and more, year after year. And that makes the CIA happy, insofar as it spells protracted war and increased profits for its sponsors in the arms industry. Afghan anger means more resistance. And more resistance provides a neat pretext for the eternal military occupation of a disposable nation strategically located near Russia and China. The Taliban will never surrender, and for the CIA, that means victory in Afghanistan. But it also means spiritual defeat for America as it descends ever further into the black hole of self-deception, militarism, and covert operations. Chapter 9. The CIA in Ukraine. Ryan Dawson. This is Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report. With me today is Doug Valentine. I'm going to be asking him tonight about the CIA's role in Ukraine and in infiltrating the media. Mr. Valentine, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Valentine, it's my pleasure. Thank you. Dawson, I want to ask you about this organization working with NGOs in the Ukraine. It's called United Action Center. I want to read something short from their page and get your thoughts. It says, "The NGO Center UA has a strong professional human potential. The team has experience running projects in the sphere of European and Euro-Atlantic integration. At the same time, the Center UA consists of experts and activists who have experience in journalism, public service, PR, public activities, etc. Also, the Center UA has an extensive database of contacts with international experts, politicians, and journalists. At the moment, the Center UA is the coordinator of the New Citizens Public Campaign, which brings together around 40 NGOs. We know from the Carl Bernstein report on the media how much the CIA has infiltrated the media. Could you give your thoughts about Center UA and what they're doing there with 40 NGOs, supposedly to promote democracy and have activists and experienced journalists working together? Valentine. The Center UA is the organization that Pierre Omidyar co-founded 2 years ago. Center UA is an umbrella organization that is linked to various activist projects and NGOs, one of which is the New Citizen Campaign, which, according to the Financial Times, played a big role in getting the protest up and running. In fact, according to the Kyiv Post, the Center UA received more than $500,000 in 2012, 54% of which came from PACT Inc., a project funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Nearly 36% came from Omidyar Network, a foundation established by eBay founder Pierre Omidyar and his wife. Other donors include the International Renaissance Foundation, whose key funder is billionaire George Soros, and the National Endowment for Democracy, funded largely by the U.S. Congress. Why did Omidyar prove willing to come on board with such known regime change sponsors as USAID and NED, to say nothing of Soros? Where else is he cooperating? It should never be forgotten that this is the kind of company he keeps. Why? While Omidyar was born in Paris and his parents moved to Maryland from France when he was young, he appears to be of Iranian descent. His mother was a Farsi linguist, and as of 2016, is president of the Roshan Cultural Heritage Institute. As bizarre as it may seem, little information is publicly available about his father, including his name. He apparently was a urologist or surgeon at Johns Hopkins, and if that was the case, his name should be available. The secrecy suggests some sort of intelligence connection, perhaps to the type of upper-class émigré circles the CIA cultivates in America. It is a fact that the CIA station in Iran served as one of the agency's main bases for agent operations against the Soviets. The CIA and Mossad created SAVAK, the Shah's notorious internal political security service, and the Shah in turn gave the CIA a free hand to run operations against the Soviets. Maybe Pierre Omidyar is accessible to U.S. foreign policy agencies due to some prior family connections. Maybe that accounts for why he spent a few hundred thousand dollars, a paltry sum for a billionaire, to help put the Center UA in place in the Ukraine, so the CIA could run operations against the Russians like it did out of Iran. I've never heard any explanation from inquisitive Glenn Greenwald. When it comes to his sugar daddy's monkey business, Greenwald's policy is pure, see no, hear no, speak no evil. Why? Is that the quid pro quo for the handout? What I do know is that billionaires like Omidyar and George Soros and the Rockefellers, to say nothing of USAID and NED, aren't funding political action out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing it to advance their interests. That's why an organization like Center UA is created, to advance the interests of its financial backers. To me, it looks like a CIA-facilitated mechanism to create a crisis in Ukraine and exploit it. The 40 NGOs it coordinates are perfectly placed to provide cover for covert CIA political action. The Center UA does, in fact, coordinate politicians and journalists with experts on international affairs and public relations. It says so on its website. All these people are involved in managing information. Maybe they're linked on a private server like Hillary Clinton used while Secretary of State. It will have occurred to the political and Psy War experts in the CIA's digital dark army that they could easily garner public support for their color revolutions by creating websites that unite and direct people, that they could manipulate potential rebels using the same, albeit updated, motivational indoctrination methods people like Frank Scotton pioneered in Vietnam. The Center UA's public relations experts certainly guide pro-American candidates in Kiev the same way American PR people manipulated Boris Yeltsin in Moscow. As is well known, Yeltsin gave away the store after he became president of the Russian Federation. In the same way the CIA promoted Yeltsin, Center UA journalists certainly make sure that pro-American politicians get favorable press. They spin the facts in such a way that Omidyar, who has made their operation possible, will be happy. The Center UA's stated purpose was to pull Ukraine out of the Russian orbit and deliver it to Western corporations. And that's what happened, along with obligatory political payoffs. Indeed, a few short years after Center UA was established, Vice President Joe Biden's son joined the board of directors of the largest Ukraine gas producer, Burisma Holdings. Hunter Biden heads Burisma's legal department and liaises with international organizations. The book Flashpoint in Ukraine provides ample evidence that the Obama regime and its privateering corporate partners overthrew the pro-Russian Ukraine government and installed a government packed with neo-Nazis and American elites. They did this for their own enrichment, and yet the U.S. media never made it an issue. It's business as usual. The average Ukrainian citizen doesn't benefit, just the super predator American elite who organized the coup. It's amazing to behold. Biden's smash-and-grab operation occurred in 2014. In 2016, another super predator, Natalie Jaresko, took control of Data Group, the company that controls Ukraine's telecom market. Jaresko at one time held a top job at the State Department, coordinating the trade and commerce agencies that dealt with the former Soviet Union, including the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. Check her out on Wikipedia. She's a part of the global elite, the IMF, World Bank, European Bank for Reconstruction and Development Network. In the Clinton administration, she served as chief of the economics section of the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine and helped pave the way for the coup d'etat that occurred there 20 years later. These coups take years to organize. Many more are planned. Jaresko acquired Ukrainian citizenship on the same day as her appointment as Minister of Finance of Ukraine in 2014. Next, she squeezed her competitor, the owner of Data Group, out of business, using the kind of foreign currency loan debt scam favored by mafia hoods and economic hitmen. That's how freewheeling capitalists work. They overload targeted nations and business people with debt and then clean them out. Again, not a word of protest from the mainstream media. It's free trade in action. The CIA plays a central role in these schemes, doing the illegal but plausibly deniable things that require high-tech espionage and underworld assets, reaching into police files or using private investigators to get dirt on people, then setting them up and blackmailing them. These kinds of subversion operations can't be done publicly by the likes of Biden or Jaresko or their PR people. Foreign shakedowns have to be done secretly through the criminal underworld, and that's where the CIA comes into play. Other times, the media plays the central role. In the U.S., for example, people win elections through negative campaigning. The Democratic Party hires investigators to get dirt on Republican candidates. Republicans do the same thing. The truth doesn't matter because events are happening instantaneously. Hyperbole becomes fact before anyone can respond. Senator Elizabeth Warren reportedly claimed to be part Native American in her application to Harvard. And once she started campaigning for Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump called her Pocahontas every chance he got. There are all sorts of ways within the eternal present of spectacular domination of influencing events through manufactured scandals and misrepresentations without it being illegal or secret. It just requires celebrity status, a Twitter account, and the attention of the networks of information control. As Guy Debord said long before the internet in his book Comments on the Society of the Spectacle, one aspect of the disappearance of all objective historical knowledge can be seen in the way that individual reputations have become malleable and alterable at will by those who control all information, information which is gathered, and also, an entirely different matter, information which is broadcast. Their ability to falsify is thus unlimited. Anyone can be smeared, And apart from the unknown protected few in the CIA and national security establishment, there's no defense. Overseas, the CIA is perpetually collecting information on adversaries like Vladimir Putin and passing it along to the Western media, which rejoices in spinning it a million different ways. What is less well known is the CIA is engaged in tipping the balance in the domestic as well as international contests. That's why it's secret and why all the privateers protect it. They share the same business ideology. CIA officers, PR people, journalists, politicians, and academics who get paid to give expert testimony on Fox or MSNBC are knowingly manipulating social and political movements here in the U.S., just like they do for the Ukrainian opposition or the Venezuelan opposition. The CIA sets up Twitter accounts and Facebook pages and social websites to move people into mass organizations to achieve its secret ends. In May 2016, Twitter cut off U.S. intelligence agencies from a service that sifts through the entire output of Twitter's social media postings. The guilty party was the CIA's open source enterprise, which contracted with a private contractor, data miner, through the CIA's ubiquitous venture capital fund, InQtel, to spy on American citizens. Such super-secret intelligence operations are frequently used as cover for highly illegal, offensive counterintelligence operations. Dawson, we saw the National Endowment for Democracy, which is totally CIA, at the forefront in the Ukraine. But why does the CIA need so many NGOs as middlemen? What is their purpose for having 40 different non-governmental organizations? Valentine, I'll give you an example. When the CIA moved into Vietnam, which had a culture the U.S. hadn't dealt with before, the first thing it did was buy a lot of property. This was during the first Indochina War, and they did this clandestinely through cutouts, so they'd have safe houses to set up organizations later on. It's always best for them to buy real estate during times of crisis when prices are down. Like Trump always says, buy low, and when are prices lowest? As Baron Rothschild famously said, when there's blood in the streets. The CIA bought huge tracts of property in Saigon in between 1952 and 1955, during the first Indochina War, when there was blood on the streets. The CIA bought prime property at 10% of its value. That's the first step, get your nose in the tent. These buildings served as places where CIA officers could meet their agents and plot dirty deeds. They passed some to NGOs and civil organizations to operate. William Colby introduced me to one of his cohorts, Clyde Bauer, the CIA officer who ran Air America in Vietnam in the early days. Bauer told me he set up South Vietnam's Foreign Relations Council, Chamber of Commerce, and Lions Club to create a strong civil base. That's what the CIA is doing in Ukraine through the Center UA. It's creating a pro-American civil base from which political candidates emerge. The CIA influences politics in foreign nations in many ways. CIA officers are constantly funneling money to all political parties, right and left, and establishing long-range agents to monitor and manipulate political developments. That's standard operating procedure. The next thing the CIA does is seize control of a nation's secret services. That's what they did in Vietnam and in Ukraine. As I've explained elsewhere, they offer training and high-tech gadgetry to people in the secret services. They corrupt them and use them for their own purposes, like they used Savak in Iran. It's highly illegal to suborn officials in foreign nations. We don't like it when it's done to us, and it's not something even an influential billionaire like Omid Yar is trained to do, although his private security force is probably staffed by former CIA officers who do know how to do it. The CIA infiltrates all the political parties, and as soon as a politician they own is in place, right or left, they can elevate him or her to defense minister or interior minister. These ministers are on the CIA payroll and appoint military, security, and police officials who do the CIA's bidding. The CIA tries to place its people throughout the captive nation's government and civil society. In South America, they recruit junior military officers via the School of the Americas, now innocuously renamed, and when the time is right, have them stage a coup with the support of all the other people they've been cultivating for years, sometimes decades. U.S. corporations need the CIA to put these parallel governments in place. The CIA penetrates the military and security services and simultaneously creates a civil base through deniable organizations like Center for UA. This is how societies are ruled when there's no overwhelming popular support, through the ownership of property, and by having the proper people in government and civic institutions. The CIA recruits people in place, like Lech Wałęsa in Poland. Often the people running the unions are on the CIA payroll. People running the education system, too. The CIA can recruit these people because it has so much money. The Russians can't compete when billionaires like George Soros are sprinkling $1 million here and $5 million there, money that goes into building civic institutions that are ideologically attuned. Whether people do it for love or money or belief of a brighter future, the CIA is manipulating the social and political processes. Its officers and their agents are recruiting people and putting them in place, having them sign contracts that effectively say, in exchange for working for us in advancing our interests here in Kiev, you will get $100,000 in a Swiss bank account and your life will be rosy. It's illegal. It's treasonous. You can't take money from a foreign intelligence agency and work against your own country. But that is what the CIA is doing in the Ukraine right now and around the world on a massive scale. Dawson, I wanted to ask you about that human intelligence. What is the Intelligence Community Directive 304? Valentine. That came out in 2009. If anybody wants to read it, it's only 4 or 5 pages long. It spells out in broad, simplistic terms what the FBI, the CIA, and the Department of Defense do for the National Director of Intelligence in terms of HUMINT. The position of Director of National Intelligence didn't exist until Bush became president in 2001. Until then, the person who supervised all intelligence operations was the Director of the CIA, who doubled as director of all intelligence agencies. After 9/11, the CIA director was no longer officially overseeing all other intelligence agencies. That role passed to the new Director of National Intelligence, which since 2010 is a position held by James Clapper. The DNI job was created by Bush to enable more political control over domestic intelligence operations. In 2009, the Director of National Intelligence issued Directive 304 to define the jobs of the military, CIA, and FBI. The most recent online copy has redactions. They cut out parts about what the CIA does. It's standard to classify the names of CIA officers in the Ukraine, what their cover positions are, who they've bribed and suborned. If the president of the Rotary Club or the police chief in Kiev is a CIA agent, those things are classified because they are illegal. But now, thanks to Directive 304, you can't even know what is unclassified about CIA operations. That is how bad it has gotten. Again, it's all about the control of information. They don't want you to know anything. That's how they exert power over you. Your rulers are obsessed with controlling information and not letting you know what goes on, the same way Greenwald hides his treasure trove of NSA documents obtained from Snowden and dribbles out only what he wants you to see, because a person's or an institution's power is directly equivalent to its ability to control the information upon which its power depends. Dawson, and to profit from it. Valentine, that's the whole point. Democracy is corrupted when your government prevents you from knowing what the CIA is doing. That kind of secrecy is the antithesis of democracy. If the public doesn't know what's going on, then it has no control over its fate. Americans have given up so much control, so much freedom. Dawson, every time they declassify something, we find out it had nothing to do with sensitive secrets. It's just hiding illegal activity. That's it. Valentine, the CIA isn't conducting secret illegal actions around the world to bring class, gender, and racial harmony to America, or encourage Palestinians and Jews to hold hands and sing Pepsi commercials together. The CIA is doing this on behalf of the Clintons and Bushes. They do it for Omidyar and Bill Gates and George Soros and the people who rule us. Dawson, They are the secretive military wing of the plutocrats. Valentine, yep. Phil Agee called the CIA capitalism's invisible army. The CIA isn't doing illegal things so the minimum wage will go up, or so that bankers will be more careful about selling mortgages to people who can't afford them. They're working with the bankers. They want Ukrainians putting their money in a Morgan Stanley brokerage firm in Kiev. They want to suck the life out of Ukrainians. That is what the CIA is there for, and they are very careful and cautious about whom they recruit to achieve that goal. Dawson, they want things that have intrinsic value. Property, farming. Valentine, yeah. The first thing they want is property, and the best way to drive prices down is to start a war. People are fleeing war zones in Iraq, Libya, and Syria. As soon as that happens, prices go down, and corporate privateers like Omidyar, Biden, and Jaresko go swooping in. Dawson, the IMF engages in predatory lending to push people into debt, so they have to start selling assets to pay the piper. When Ukraine started making deals with the Russians, suddenly there's a coup d'etat. It just makes me laugh that the NGOs that are coordinated by the Center UA are talking about spreading democracy when the current government in Western Ukraine was appointed. Valentine, sure. The history of the U.S. intelligence operations in Ukraine is educational. OSS officers in World War II released Stepan Bandera from prison in 1944. Bandera was a Nazi collaborator whose militia slaughtered Poles, Jews, and communist workers on the Eastern Front. The U.S. recruited Bandera so he could fight the advancing Soviet Union. Nothing has changed. Just over 10 years ago, the CIA initiated its Orange Revolution for the same purpose, to thwart the Russians. It was one of the first color revolutions, and it involved the same people the CIA employed in its coup in 2014. Dawson, the dioxin poison scandal. Valentine, the wife of the acting president of the Ukraine in 2014 is an American, and she's part of a Ukrainian exile faction. The CIA has a stable full of exiles from everywhere. Ngo Dinh Diem was living in exile in America when Ed Lansdale and the CIA installed him as president in South Vietnam. He was sweeping floors at Mary Knoll Seminary in Lakewood, New Jersey. They keep their exiles in storage and activate them and their agent networks when required. A current example is Fethullah Gulen, the America-based Turkish exile and business magnate who tried to overthrow Prime Minister Erdogan in July 2016. As Joshua Cook reported in 2014, Gulen came to the United States in 1999 due to cited health problems and has stayed in the United States after gaining his visa with help from former CIA officials. The FBI previously resisted granting permanent residency status to Gulen. According to leaked cables, parts of the U.S. government believed that Gulen is a radical Islamist whose moderate message cloaks a more sinister and radical agenda. Cook reported that Gulen-inspired schools are the largest charter network in the U.S. and receive approximately $150 million a year in taxpayer money. There are about 130 of these charter schools in 26 states where the majority of the teachers are from Turkey, and many of the contracts for construction and operation have gone to Turkish businesses. Those actions have raised red flags for the U.S. government. People like Diem and Gulen come out from under their rocks and fill the governmental and civic institutions the CIA creates in nations it subverts. This is another thing it does all around the world. Dawson, we saw in Cuba, for example, the CIA actually hired out Meyer Lansky and the mafia to do its dirty work. Then we see the Ukrainian government hiring out a bunch of neo-Nazis. Valentine, as usual, I was taking the long road to get to my point, but yes, the CIA has been operating with Ukrainian exiles since the end of World War II, when they hired Reinhard Gehlen. Gehlen had been the chief anti-Soviet spy for the German army. U.S. Army intelligence hired Gehlen in 1945, but as soon as the CIA was formed, it grabbed him and put him in charge of Eastern Europe. The CIA used this former Nazi to reactivate the spy networks he had in Ukraine, Poland, Latvia, all the Eastern European countries. And these old Nazi spies and saboteurs went to work for the CIA. Dawson, they did the same thing in Japan, They got Yakuza and former Japanese spies to spy on the Chinese. They needed that intelligence, and they didn't have enough Chinese speakers or people who could infiltrate. So they kept the same Imperial Japanese who had been there during World War II. Valentine, all of this is illegal, but this is what the CIA does all around the world. It's been doing it in the Ukraine for generations. It has the grandchildren of Nazis on its payroll, an incredible infrastructure of neo-Nazi secret agents who've been battling against Russia for 70 years. The Russians know their names, where they live, where the CIA has its safe houses, but the American public has no clue. They think the crisis began today because of the way the news is presented. The journalists, their editors, the industry owners, the publishers, which now include Omidyar, don't want you to know about all the illegal activities the CIA is involved in on their behalf. So the owners of the New York Times and the Washington Post hire editors who will direct reporters in such a way that they never report on what the CIA is doing. Dawson, some of them are CIA. Valentine, journalism in the U.S. is a traditional cover for CIA officers. And when the owners of the media aren't covering for the CIA, they're selling commercial time slots to the multinational corporations that in turn are selling you commodities made in sweatshops in foreign nations that have been subverted by the CIA. You could almost say there's no such thing as factual reporting. It's as valuable as most of the overpriced commodities people buy to elevate their status. Everything is twisted and delivered in 9-second sound bites. So you'll buy something, not know something, or forget about something. Dawson, if anyone is confused, just look at the reporting on Ukraine, or the reporting during the build-up to the Iraq War. Look how uniform all these three-letter networks were. The reporting got debunked online, yet on television you had a completely one-sided story. It's pro-war, pro-coup d'etat. Valentine, the problem, in my opinion, is not that the CIA infiltrated journalism, but rather that the CIA is promoting the business of journalism, which is actually the advertising branch of capitalism. They're working together. The reliable journalists who report on the CIA, guys like Seymour Hersh, never say the things I'm saying here. The CIA and the media are part of the same criminal conspiracy. You're never going to learn anything substantive by reading what mainstream reporters dish out about the CIA. You can't take a journalism course in CIA Criminal Conspiracies 101. Dawson, that's why I made a documentary film called Decades of Deception that went over a bunch of covert operations that had been busted wide open, that the CIA was involved with or completely in control of. But getting that out there is a drop in the bucket compared to what the mass media disseminates and how much bull we're fed in school and from television. Valentine, American society, since its creation 240 years ago, has had as its goal the enrichment and empowerment of a small group of property owners and their succeeding generations, who, after they conquered the continent, took over the world. The civic and government institutions in the USA have been organized for over 240 years to advance that purpose. The fact that the CIA came along 70 years ago and pushed the process forward by doing illegal things on an industrial basis hasn't changed the thrust of the American empire and its frontmen. The people who control the Center UA and manage its operations in Ukraine are doing the same thing here. It's the same rulers. It's the same PR people and journalists, the same politicians, and they are doing the same things. Just trace the provenance of so many of them. Dawson, and they can distort massive events. I mean trying to get one newspaper or one talking head to mention that Palestine is under occupation. It will never happen. Never. Valentine. And yet people really think that they have freedom here. I guess it's all relative. But if you start to know a little bit, you realize you don't know much truth at all. Dawson. The internet is making a small dent in it, but not enough. Not yet, but I have hope in it anyway. Valentine. I'm 66. When I started writing back in the early 1980s, it could take a month to get in touch with someone to learn a particular fact. Things are faster now, but CIA is faster now, too. It created a new digital directorate so it can more perfectly control internet information. The control of scientific and technological information is as important as the control of words, the intellectual information that is written down or broadcast. Control of scientific information is a means of controlling our ideas and assumptions about things. Just as the CIA is at the forefront of propaganda on the Internet, its science and technology division is at the forefront of shaping the industries that run the world. The CIA is at the forefront of drone and weapons technology, any kind of technological advancements that only serve and enrich the ruling class. The CIA is at the forefront of that research and development, and that goes for the Internet too. Back in the mid-1990s, I took a class in the hypertext language. And to my surprise, we were taught that all information was routed through superprocessors in Langley. Putin recently said that the Internet was a CIA special project, and he was right. I remember when the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency came out with ARPANET, which started helping us to access information in college libraries back in the early 1990s. It was all done under the Department of Defense, which was fronting for the CIA. So our Internet capabilities are a new freedom, but at the same time, we enjoy this freedom by the leave of the CIA. If they wanted to, they could shut it down in a minute. They control it, and they monitor every aspect of it. If we actually were doing something that threatened them, they would know about it in a nanosecond, and our activities would be stopped. But we're just mosquitoes. Dawson, the FCC has already moved to destroy net neutrality in the U.S. I see that Internet freedom as kind of a black swan. You have all these commercial purposes, definitely. People like Omidyar making money selling things online. But I am not sure if they worried that there would be people who would become self-made journalists and start reporting on all the horrible things they do. Valentine, people are addicted to the Internet now. And if Bill Gates or Omidyar wanted to, they could start charging you a dollar a day. It's like a drug. Well, the first shot is for free, and now it's time for them to start charging. Nothing happening on the Internet right now is indicative of what's going to be going on in 5 years. This whole Internet fantasy could turn nightmarish very soon. Dawson, well, that's pretty dark, but you may be right. At least they are charging people on the service end to provide it, and they are not happy about it. But you can completely control information if you can decide who is fast and who is slow. That is all it takes. Valentine, if you were an Internet entrepreneur, how many different ways do you think you could come up with making millions off it? People are addicted to iPhones and texting. The entrepreneurs are hanging around the schoolyard, and they are giving you free Skype. The CIA, too. If the Brits could get away with pushing opium on China in 1848, what makes you think the CIA won't do it here now? Dawson, do opium? Ha! Valentine, we'll have to come back in 5 years and see if I'm right. Dawson, I'm not arguing against you. I just don't want to believe it. You know, because it's dark. Valentine, enjoy the good times, because these little bits of freedom that we have now may be the last. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. It's like Directive 304, which you could once find online, but is now classified. Civil liberties are diminishing, not increasing. The Supreme Court just said that nobody can challenge Obama's right to detain. Dawson, he kills without trial, too. Valentine, they can do anything, and it's not going to get better